Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
John Wertheim at this week's Sports Illustrated Black Tennis Channel Tennis Podcast. Be back from vacation edition, but we are still going to wrap up Wimbledon 2019, a remarkable tournament, and we are going to do it with no better guest than Robbie Koenig, who a lot of you know, former ATP pro, now one of the best analysts in the business, insightful, incisive, says what he thinks what he says. Great guy, and he has a lot of thoughts about Federer, Djokovic's mental strength, the lost opportunity for Roger, the women's event, and just some good tennis talk overall. So let's just bring him on now without further ado. Here is Robbie, and good chat to follow. It's 8 days after the Wimbledon final, and I ask you, with a little bit of a time thickening here, Roger Federer feels blank today.
I can totally understand him feeling disappointed, gutted that a golden opportunity has slipped through his fingers to add another major title to his haul and join Martina at 9 singles titles at Wimbledon. And I think it's one that he might rue for a long time. I think it only gets harder to win these things as you get older.
Anger, disappointment, nightmares. What how do you think this manifests itself?
You know, John, I think it's the worst thing for a player to have match points and lose. I've been down that path, on the doubles court at around a 16 match at the US Open, and that was nightmarish for me for months. I can't imagine what it must be like in the finals with the opportunity to beat Rafa and Djokovic in back-to-back matches. I don't think he'd ever done that at Grand Slam level before. Not many have. Nope. So that would have been an incredible feat in itself. And I think a lot of people wrote Roger off against Nadal. They thought Nadal was going to win that. And they thought at best he would get a set against Djokovic in the final. So I think to come so tantalizingly close, and he was asked that question in the press, would it have been easier to accept if he had lost 2-2 and 2. You know what? In some ways, I think it is a little bit easier to accept, because when you have match points and lose matches like this, and the fact that it's the third time it's happened at a major now against Djokovic, I just think it stings even more. And I just wonder to myself, and of course these guys don't operate the same thought process and the same sort of boundaries that us mere mortals do, John,
right.
That whether this could be a somewhat of a decline from here on in for Roger, in the way that the 2017 win in Australia was a big springboard for him to grab a few more majors. I'm just wondering if this will put him over the edge now and see him on a different path.
I'll give you two words that I would add to that. I think you're absolutely right. I think if someone beats you like Serena was beaten in the final, and someone said, well, what would you rather do, lose the way Serena did, 2-2, less than an hour, or Roger? And to me, it's not even a close call. That someone beats you 2-2, you say too good, I'll get them next time, but today wasn't my day, where are we going for dinner? You lose
in a 5-hour match with history on the line, and you mentioned Martinez 9 Wimbledons, but also 21 majors is padding your lead, and that didn't happen. But the other thing is, how significant the two words I was going to add were on serve. That those match points did not come, you know, in a tiebreak, and a guy serves a bomb, and there's nothing you can do. I mean, he was serving for the match. I wonder how much that has to do with it, that you had control.
Yeah, that just adds to the pain, right? That adds further to the missed opportunity, you know. And it's not like it's Diego Schwartzman on serve. No disrespect to Diego, but it's one of the greatest servers, right. One of the greatest serves we've ever had in our sport. It's been the cornerstone of his game, the fact that he's been able to win so many matches comfortably in majors, so that when he does get to the back end of majors, you know, he's got plenty of gas left in the tank. And that serve has been critical to being able to do that. So again, it just adds fuel to the fire. And yeah, I'm repeating myself a bit here, but that will sting even more. And especially if memory serves at 15 all, he had 2 aces to go up 40-15, John. So it was like he was in a good rhythm. You've got a little bit of rhythm there. You've just served 2 great serves. I mean, against Djokovic, it would be interesting if we actually went back in the match and see that if he had served 2 aces consecutively at all in the whole match, let alone hit 2 in a row to get him to match points.
I'll give you another one. I was watching this with Paul Anacone in the studio, who knows Roger, obviously, as well as anyone. And at 40-15... So, you know, double championship point, double point to win your 21st major. Roger hit a serve up the tee, and Djokovic guessed wrong. I mean, what wouldn't have even been, would have been an ace by a mile. Djokovic wasn't even close. It was a great strategic play, and it missed clearing the net by 2 inches. I mean, it just ticked the net. Those are the, if this thing is 2 inches higher, Djokovic doesn't get a racket on it, and These are the, when everyone says the margins are thin, this literally is a 2-inch difference between 21 majors and a happy ending for Roger and greatest ever and, you know, 16 years between majors and this dark, dark, deep disappointment.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
What about the other side of the net? What did you learn about Djokovic a week ago Sunday?
I learned that this guy, he didn't even play his very best tennis in the final, is going to be very difficult to beat in the next 3 or 4 years. Mm. You know, it wasn't the best Djokovic that we've seen. We saw the best of Djokovic in the finals of the Australian Open. Of course, you've got to take into consideration who's on the other side of the net and that it's his favorite surface.
Right.
But I think Djokovic still had a gear and a half to go to as far as his best is concerned. And I think the fact that he can still win not playing his best, playing at, you know, 80-85%, just is going to make it very difficult for the rest of the field to beat him in majors. And it's almost like they need an extreme scenario like we saw unfold at the French Open in order for him to lose. I think he is so clutch mentally. It showed us how strong he is mentally. It really is just an affirmation of everything that Novak is all about. This ability in the last, what are we now, since 2011, 8 years, right, to be the dominant force whether he's playing well or not, against two of the greatest players to ever play the game. And I think mentally we learned a lot about him in his post-match press conference. There were some very interesting things that were said. He spoke a lot about visualization and how, you know, in his mind, he turned everything around when the chants were for Rodgers' name.
Right.
He visualized it and heard it being Novak's name. And, of course, everybody in the press room laughed. Not him, though, because he knows how important that was to his success. And he knows how important it is to be strong mentally. And you get the sense, John, that he works on it on a daily basis. I think in a lot of sports, sportsmen and sportswomen speak about the importance of being tough mentally, but how many actually practice visualization and mental training on a daily basis? I get the sense that he does.
You are stealing all my lines. I am so with you on this. And I think that a few years ago, he spoke about visualization and self-actualization and the whole peace and love phase and the guru, and everybody sort of giggled, and sports and psychology as an overlap still has a while to go, still has a ways to go. And it's one of these things. If you tell me you're serving wide, I can see you serving wide. If you tell me you're feeling self-actualized, that doesn't necessarily, that's not something that translates to the fan. And I feel like gradually he is showing, and I think that bit you said, I think that's absolutely right. That bit about hearing the crowd, and when they say Roger, Roger, you're hearing Novak, Novak, that's a concrete example. But I feel as though one of Novak's legacies is going to be that he has really not just taken the stigma off of all of this mental health and on all of this sort of the spiritual component to sports, but the results kind of speak for themselves. I mean, you giggle all you want at you know, health and wellness, and some of his tweets seem a little sort of touchy-feely and a little bit out there. But I think that final, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that he gave that concrete example of hearing the crowd cheering for him when you and I both know it was probably 95-5 for the other guy. I think this is really significant, not just in his career, but I think this is going to be one of his real legacies, that he did not reinvent tennis. He didn't serve differently. It's not like Nadal, who brought a completely different geometry and sensibility to the sport. But I think this whole business of mental health is going to be really part of Djokovic's tennis legacy.
Anyway, too true, John.
We agree.
Too true. And, you know, those guys, I mean, I enjoy reading a lot of psychology books, and, you know, they talk about it as the principle of universal energy. And, you know, he talks about energy and all that sort of stuff. And he is able to connect with it. It's very interesting. I had a long chat with Gebhard Fildgrich, who's his physical trainer. And, you know, he doesn't like to do anything in a gym.
Right. Little
time as possible in a gym. He likes to be outdoors. Everything has to be structured outdoors. Upper body exercises will be things like canoeing. Likes to do a lot of running without shoes on. Feel the earth beneath his feet. Riding a bike up a hill rather than doing a stationary bike in a gym. So he does everything that he possibly can to embrace and connect with that power that he and many psychologists call universal energy. And, you know, in a small way, I had that when I came back from injury as a 22-year-old and started reading many different books about it. And you know what? I couldn't believe the difference it made to my game on a small scale. So, and I wasn't as disciplined as this guy. I had a bit of success for 6 months and I kind of forgot about it. So when you've got somebody who is so dedicated to mental training, and we all speak about it, but he actually does it, I'm not surprised that he gets the results that he gets. Some people might call it luck, call it whatever you want, surviving these match points, got a little lucky, but he's got lucky too often
right.
for it to be luck.
No, I totally agree with you. And I think if Stan Wawrinka says, I lost 10 pounds and here's a selfie and you can see my abs, that makes immediate sense to everyone. If someone says, I'm feeling positive energy and I'm visualizing success in a new way and I'm connecting with my chakra, that's less concrete. Someone else, I was talking to, I don't want to sell him out, but I do want to quote him. A recent top 10 player who also, okay. he had a theory too. He said, look, everyone knows there is not a lot of warmth that passes between Federer and Djokovic. I mean, again, you see they played a five-hour match, 7-6 in the fifth, the Wimbledon final. Compare that to the post-match, not just the handshake, but sort of the post-match spirit after the 2008 final with Rafa and Roger versus the spirit the other night. I mean, it's clear. I don't know if there's active dislike, but it's clear that there's some friction and there's not a lot of warmth that passes between Roger and Novak. And this former player said that Novak responds to that much better than Roger does. And Roger wants to like everyone and wants everyone to like him and doesn't need tension and is much more comfortable when there's a certain fondness. And Novak is much more comfortable with the confrontation and sort of the personal animus. And he thought that played a role in the final. You have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's definitely fair comment. But your American was coming out of me there saying 7-6 in the fifth, I think, John.
What did he say? 7-6 in the fifth? What did I say?
No, you said 7-6 in the fifth. I thought it was 13-12 in the fifth.
Oh, yeah, exactly. That, you're right. the tiebreaker threw me. No, you're right. It was 13. It was. We're all getting used to. We can talk about that too. We're all. You're absolutely right. We're all getting used to this. It was a tiebreak at 12-all. How quickly we forget. But we can talk about that as well. But yeah, you're.
No, I hear where you're coming from. Taken. But just to get back to your point, I think you're right. I think almost by virtue of the upbringing that Djokovic has had, where, you know, war torn, fight for everything that you had, you know, he's spoken about people chasing his parents for money, and it's him against the world, not too dissimilar to an Andy Murray kind of attitude, and he doesn't mind that confrontation. In fact, he almost relishes it, you know, whereas the guy who comes from Switzerland, you know, the perfectly neutral country, much more harmonious, the equilibrium
right.
is always there when he plays. And I think it's a very valid point. And, you know, Roger and Rafa have what they've had for so many years. But you know, I think you even see it with Djokovic and Nadal to a large degree. I saw a lovely montage of them shaking hands. It had done up to about 40 of their matches that I played in the early years when Nadal was winning. It was all very amicable, arm around the guy that he was beating on a regular basis. But it was amazing how that unfolded over the next, you know,
wait, who,
20
who,
or 50
who
handshakes.
Wait, that's
the
really interesting.
Djokovic
wait, who
started
are you,
winning.
Who are you talking about, though? What players are you, just to be clear, what players are you talking about now?
No, so that was initially, you know, when I was comparing handshakes. And
right,
I was,
right.
You know, I was saying that, you know, in the early years when Djokovic and Nadal were shaking hands, you know, that was very amicable from Nadal's side because he was winning a lot. But that's changed a lot in the last, you know, 10 or 15 times that they've played. There's a bit of animosity towards Djoko as well in the Nadal camp because, you know, he's been beating him on a regular basis. I don't think it's quite the same from Federer's side, but it's still a bitter pill to swallow for both of them because of his pugilistic nature. He's very in your face, I think, more so than what they are.
Yeah, I mean, it is funny that the guy that speaks about harmony and about energy and spirits lining up is also the guy of the three, anyway, who's the more likely to rip his shirt and sort of has these ebbs and flows and as much. I mean, he's more like Murray, where at least up until the final, he does not seem like the guy. You know what he's thinking. He does not go to great lengths the way Federer and Nadal do to sometimes suppress emotion and frustration. It's all kind of fascinating,
yeah,
though, isn't it?
No, it is. You know, I mean, it's such a good point you raise. I'm almost contradicting myself, as you say. You talk about this harmonious mental state, but I think the key is when he loses it, he loses it for a moment or two, and then he's quickly back into trying to find his equilibrium again.
Right.
But
right.
Yeah, to balance those two opposites is not easy. But I think he does an unbelievable job of doing it. And you know, as we both know, I think in 2008, everybody had chosen sides. You were either a Federer fan or a Djokovic or a Nadal fan.
Right.
And then obviously this guy comes in between everybody. So I think, he gets a bit of a raw deal because I don't think the Federer fans have enjoyed it. And I don't think the Nadal fans have enjoyed him, you know, coming between their two men.
No, I mean, I think there's a lot there. I think there's an element of culture. And I think there's an element of, you know, people don't have firm thoughts about Serbia and the Balkans the way they do about, hey, it's a cute little island off of Spain, and we love Switzerland. I mean, I think there's a lot about how fans process origin stories. And I think you're right. I think some of this is just timing, and that everybody had already cast their vote at the ballot box, and then here comes this third-party candidate, and it's, you know, wait a second. I'm with Roger. I'm with Rafa. And I also always say that the Rafa-Roger rivalry had a certain sort of feel-good nature to it, mostly sparked by that. You know, you remember the video where they're both giggling, and you sort of said, wait, you two guys are rivals. You're supposed to hate each other. This is supposed to be Red Sox-Yankees, and here you are, and you can't keep a straight face when you film an ad together, and it's so warm, and then here comes this third-party candidate that changes the whole dynamic. You know, it's like having a roommate that changes the whole that dynamic of the college dorm room. So let me ask you this. One of the topics that I feel like we all love this, you know, we all love this three-way derby, and there's so many dimensions to it. I mean, I sort of am of the mind. I feel like, you know, when you call a fancy restaurant for a waiter and they for a reservation and they put you on hold, I feel like all of this proclamation and greatest of all time, we just need to wait until these careers are all finished before we start making any declarations. But I also feel like the other part of this whole conversation is, where's the bench? Where are the guys 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 who are challenging? I mean, I think we all knew when the draw came out for Wimbledon that, boy, Djokovic is really lucky because he's in the half of the draw that doesn't have the other two. And so part of this whole discussion about the big three, I think also there's an element of, what's the problem with the other 125 players in the draw who aren't mustering much of a challenge? A lot of theories floating around why. Do you, and I don't think there's one answer necessarily, but where's everyone else? What's the problem with the rest of the field?
I think the problem with the rest of the field is they've grown up in a generation in the last 10 or 15 years when it comes to developing their game, where the game has become very, what's the correct word? I guess vanilla in the way it's played now. Every single person plays the same way. The string technology, the racket technology, slowing down the courts hasn't encouraged creativity in our sport enough. You swing as hard as you can with a powerful racket and Luxilon strings.
Right.
And, you know, you become as beast of an athlete as you possibly can. And, you know, you've got a decent shot of having a career. And everybody's always scared of deviating from the norm and what is working. So that's why you get what we have now. And I think that is part of the problem with the sport. I had a lovely discussion with Kevin Curran not so long ago, former Wimbledon finalist in 85. And, you know, he often said to me, Rob, I don't believe that the dimensions of the court and the heights of the net in particular was created for, first of all, for people who are 6'3", 6'4" on average, or 6'2" on average, whatever it might be these days.
Right.
And don't forget, back in the early days, you played with 65 square inch wooden rackets that were so heavy, so you couldn't hit the ball over the net with these incredible amounts of spins. So it's almost like a different sport that we're playing from what our forefathers probably had in mind, where it was work the rally a bit, come and hit a few volleys, and then maybe finish it off with a smash at the end. So I think our sport is lacking creativity, and this next gen of players don't have enough tools at their disposal to outthink and outmuster these three guys who have so many. And of course, Nadal is the ultimate beast. So he has become more beastly than anybody else who's tried to play the way that this new generation is playing. So he is the kingpin there. They've got a lot of catching up to do. He's so unique in that department. And in the other two, or Roger, you've got somebody who's just so unique that we're not going to see in our lifetime again.
Right,
I don't think
right.
so. And then in Djokovic, you've got somebody who's almost like a hybrid of the two. So it's the situation that is so incredibly unique. It's like having three Usain Bolts. In fact, you might have even used that analogy when we were chatting at Wimbledon. It's like having three Eliud Kipchoges. I mean, at the same time. Nobody thought we'd get to Pete's 14 majors for a long time.
Right.
We've got three in the next generation who have also passed that and then some.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think we also need to say these three guys are just tremendous. So any discussion of where's the rest of the field, you don't want to shortchange the three guys on top. I still think money has a lot to do with this.
In terms of what, John?
I think in a lot of ways. I think part of it is just resources, right? That these guys have personal, you know, toenail clippers, and it's very, when you make $50, $60, $70 million a year, and you're not flying coach, and you have a whole team, and everything, every creature comfort, every piece of science. I mean, Roger, I don't know if you saw the piece that Simon Briggs did, that at least Novak and Roger are spending, you know, six figures on analytics. I mean, they're spending more on analytics than the guy on the other side of the net might be making in a year before his expenses. I mean, that's a huge competitive advantage. But I also think the flip side of that is I think there's enough money so that you can be number 15 in the world and live an awfully nice life and have a real conversation. Is it really worth changing your lifestyle and your life and your priorities and your personal relationships to really challenge these guys? How many guys are there, do you think, in the top 40 who say, you know what, I'm perfectly comfortable. I've got a nice chunk of change coming in, and I have, I get to drive what kind of car I want to drive. It's a good life. Does Nick Kyrgios really have any sort of financial pressure to be a better player? You know, he makes $4 million a year by being Nick Kyrgios. Does he really want to change that to make a run at these guys, or is he complacent with where he is? So I think the money is sort of a shield and a sword for the big three. Do you want to attack me? Go ahead.
I like the way that you suggested it. And I think your second point is very strong, where the guys are making a lot of money. So it's how much do you want to take yourself out of your comfort zone to be even better? And there's no guarantee that you'll make that much more.
Exactly.
Is it worth all the effort?
Right.
So, and I didn't think of that side as much when you initially asked me your question. So I definitely agree with that. As far as analytics go,
where are you with that?
I'm around it a lot, and we deal a lot with Hawkeye and have been for many, many years before, you know, Craig O'Shaughnessy used to chat with me about Hawkeye and stuff long before he started doing his own stuff with Novak. And I think there's a time and a place with analytics, but in a sport where things can change in every rally, analytics is only a part of the equation. I think we've become obsessed with people who accumulate analytics, but there's not enough good interpreters.
Exactly.
So I think that's important first, you know, who's interpreting the information. And secondly, you've got to be able to execute. At the end of the day, you can know that if John Wertheim is playing against Novak Djokovic and he knows that Djokovic likes to serve down the middle to his backhand, you know, if John hasn't got the skill to make that return meaningful, at the end of the day, you can know it's going there. Yes, it helps you to make the return. But if it's short and central, then you're in trouble. It doesn't matter that much. It might matter at the nth degree, maybe in a big match. But, I think you've got to be careful when you go down the analytics road that, again, and it's the same with technique. You become so obsessed with technique, you don't know how to manage a shot under pressure. That's a very interesting discussion as well that I like to have. You know, when you get to 20, don't start tinkering with technique too much. Stick with what you can do with your strengths and weaknesses. Know your strengths and weaknesses. And I think analytics is very similar in that, you know, a lot of people will self-propagate. They want to be seen as the guru of analytics, but I'm not sure that it gives guys like Djokovic and Federer a significant advantage, a significantly more advantage. You know, they've been doing well long before we started to pay forensic scrutiny to analytics, and I'm just wary of that.
Yeah, I think you're totally with you.
It's not a science like baseball or other sports. I don't know what you feel. Maybe I'm barking up the wrong tree.
No, I feel like we need to disagree about something here. I think you're absolutely right, and I think so much of tennis is contextual, and some of it is, you know, where are the shadows on the court,
and what happened the last time I came to the net. And I think some of these statistics are so misused that, you know, a guy comes to the net 20 times and he's successful 14 times. And someone says, well, shit, he should have gone to the net more. He won 70% of his points. And you say, no, he chose 20 instances where he was going to maximize his chance to win the point. I mean, it's so much of this. I had Hawkeye, and I love those guys. I think some of the stuff they have is really fantastic, and it's very clever. But I also think a lot of it gets dirty in a hurry. That if you look at, I had looked at net clearance, for example, which players have the shortest and the greatest net clearance. And what you realize is, a guy, you know, a hard charging guy comes to the net and you throw up five topspin lobs because your opponent is coming in on you, and that changes your net clearance. And that may have no bearing on the match, but it can distort the statistics. So I think tennis is so much about context and so much about the matchup and so much about what the player on the other side of the net is doing or not doing, that if a guy's guarding the line, yeah, you might serve to the body more. That doesn't mean it's necessarily your tactic. You're playing to the context. So I think that,
absolutely.
You know, more data is always better than less data, but I think you're absolutely right that the application really needs to be, especially in this sport. A free throw is a free throw. So, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, and especially in break points, I'd like a category as well for break points. When if a person has a poor break point conversion rate, for example, you know, in those break points, how many were forced errors, or how many times did the guy hit a winner against you? Because I think that is of vital importance, because I think it puts the statistic in a much more clearer light. If you've missed five short forehands on the break points
that's
a different story.
Right. No, and that's why I said the same thing about Federer, not just having two match points, but on his serve at 40. I mean, that's a lot different than I've got a match point against John Isner and he serves 138 on hits the line, nothing I can do. That's a lot different from you're in a 50-50 neutral rally and, you know, shank a backhand. But anyway, the other thing I wanted to ask you, though, that was really interesting when this discussion about what's happened to the rest of the field and why are these three guys still allowed to ride high deep into their 30s? And so I think it was Judy Murray, and we like Judy Murray, so we're going to credit her anyway. I think it was Judy Murray who pointed out that these three guys grew up before the iPhone, and that growing up with phones and social media has a real manifest bearing on focus and concentration, and that it's not insignificant, it's not coincidental that these three guys were pre-phone and basically the rest of the field. And I've heard these stories. I mean, there's a top 10 player, and one of his coaches says we couldn't play practice sets. He couldn't get through a whole practice set without walking over to the chair and checking his social media. You think there's any validity to that? That the phone really plays a big bearing, especially in you're competing in 3 of 5 matches that could go 5 hours, and short attention spans and social media instant gratification is one of the reasons these three guys are able to continue to triumph. Think there's anything there?
Well, that's a fascinating discussion to have. And I think, you know, I'm no guru in social media and the effect that the phone has, but from what you read, you know, attention spans are becoming shorter and shorter for kids. And in a tennis context, let me play devil's advocate here. I guess I could say that you don't have to keep your concentration for 5 hours straight. You know, you're basically keeping your concentration and then you're playing a point. You've got that downtime in between points before you play the next point where the concentration is maxed out. So maybe I could argue that your concentration is ebbing and flowing in a match, and you're not always jacked up for 5 hours in maximum concentration. You've got the change of ends as well.
Right.
Just to tone down and perhaps not have to think about tennis, but man, I'm not sure if I've got the right answer to that, but it is a fascinating thought to have that in this day and age, kids do not concentrate as well as they do. Maybe, you know, playing in the sand in the back garden for 2 or 3 hours had certain benefits to tennis players that we didn't know about. But,
No, but you think about Roger, you know, Roger riding his bike.
Interesting. It was more of a thought exercise, I think. But I know, I think it's interesting. All right, we've given short shrift to the women. Let's try to correct that. Thoughts on the women's draw? Yes. Simona Halep, big. That's a huge clutch match performance. But thoughts on the women's draw in general?
So many good storylines. I mean, obviously from, you know, an American standpoint, of continuity of greatness in the women's game is Coco Gauff is an incredible story. The first week, she pretty much lit up the first week on her own. Such an exciting talent, the poise. I mean, my boy's 15 years old. He loves this tennis. He wants to pursue tennis as a career. Could I even imagine him playing on center court and doing as well as she did? It's mind-boggling stuff, John. It's incomprehensible.
I think a lot of us did the same thing.
I'm a tennis fan.
Right. I think it's great
for the future of the game. I think it's so important to have Americans do well in the sport, men or women, such a big market. So that's great. You know, probably a match that I don't know how much was talked about by you guys, and it was a match that I commentated on, and that's the success that Alison Risk had. That really resonated with me. Somebody who's a little older, really excelling on a surface she deserves to excel on, and how close she was. One of the best matches I commentated, her first match against Donna Vekic, man. What quality from those two. I couldn't believe it. Court number one, she was down and out, down 4-1, break points to go down 5-1. Next thing you know, she's in the quarterfinals of Wimbledon. But the manner in which she got there, that really resonated with me. Big time.
And she has since gotten married, I'll hasten to add.
Say that again, John.
She has since she is still Alison Risk, but she now has a husband since Wimbledon. She got married over the weekend.
I saw those pictures and the dancing going on from Alison's side. You know, someone who disappoints me is Sloane Stephens. I think she is one of the greatest natural athletes I've ever seen on a tennis court. And I believe she should be challenging regularly at the sharp end of these majors. I think, you know, I should be penciling her into the semifinals almost every major. That's how good I think she is. So, yes, she lost to Jo Konta. And that's a fantastic story as well. You know, she has somebody who struggled for a while after having initial success in Wimbledon. But to come back and play as well as she has done, I think that's a fantastic story. She got a hard time at a press conference after the loss from some journalists. But I think they'll never understand what a tennis player goes through. I think it's the toughest sport out there by far. And I'll have a discussion with anybody about it. So I've got a lot of admiration for what Joe's done. Laura Davis, what a good story that was. You know, beating the defending champion early on. The manner in which she beat her, I thought, was incredible. The way she just beat her down in that deciding set. It was a nice little storyline again for me, commentating on that match. And certainly from an American perspective, that was good. And maybe I should ask you this question. Did you think Ash Barty would go a little further than what she did?
Yeah, I mean, you know, she ran into to Ali Risk, did she not? I did. And I don't know. I think there's so much to like about Ash Barty. And it's understandable. She hadn't been home. It had been a long run. She'd had this win streak. She'd played well on the grass before. I don't think there was anything, you know, she should walk away with her head high. But I don't get the feeling she quite embraced the opportunity that was there. I mean, but between Serena, you know, but between not a lot of grass court specialty and seeds dropping out left and right, you mentioned Kerber was knocked out early, Naomi Osaka out early. You know, Ash Barty can move on the surface. She can play on the surface. I don't think it was by no stretch was it a disgrace. She went, but I think I do wonder as her career progresses if she will see this as a big missed opportunity. Who knows how she would have fared? I mean, Halep, I think, deserves all sorts of credit for basically playing as well as she can possibly play in two of the biggest matches of her career. And this is someone who's had some disappointments throughout the journey. It was not a given by any stretch that she would come out and blitz Serena Williams like that. But I think you're right. I think the Ash Barty point is interesting because I think everybody warmed to her and everybody sort of had the same, well, heck, if she can do it on clay, why the hell can't she do it on grass? And she looked terrific for about 10 matches in there. But Yeah, but these opportunities don't come along so often, and you'd like to think you could figure out ways to win matches like that. But I think those are good. I like those storylines. It's interesting. We have not you didn't mention Serena, and I'm not sure where she goes from here.
Serena for last, because I think it'll be fascinating how she goes forward from here. Will she play more? I think it's important for her now to realize that she needs to play more going into these big tournaments if she wants to win another major and get to number 24. But in many ways, I think it's having the humility now after not grabbing a title for a while to say, okay, you know what? I need to play more. I can't just show up to the big dance and pull it off now. And is she willing to do that? Because we know that if she gets matches under her belt, gets the fitness. I think that was the biggest thing for me. You know, the movement was exposed very well by Halep against her. She was struggling to go coast to coast two or three shots in a row. And the thing that surprised me, and a lot of people might not have seen it, was that neither player played very high-ranked opposition getting to the final. I think Halep's average ranking of opponent was about 83, and I think Serena was 78, and it might have been vice versa. But, you know, Serena wasn't tested that much. So perhaps in coming up against Halep playing as well as she did, it was the worst-case scenario for Serena.
I think the highest-ranked opponents – I don't have it in front of me. I think the highest-ranked opponent she had was Julia Gurgis, Carlos Suarez Navarro, who'd never won a set from her. I mean, Serena's draw was awfully nice, and she played herself into form. She was terrific in the semifinals against Strycova. I just think that, I worry about Serena because I feel like on grass you don't have to play that kind of defense, and you can camouflage. You can camouflage the movement, especially against lesser opponents. It was exposed against Halep, who I think you're right. Turned that into a track meet and was clearly the more fluid mover and the better athlete. But I worry if Serena's movement is exposed on grass where you don't have to play as much defense, I don't know what that means for the rest of the year for her. Yeah, and remember, she usually shuts it down after the U.S. Open. So, I mean, in theory, she's got one more chance, and then perhaps we'll see you in Australia. So... all right, let me ask you one more. Go ahead.
John, one more thing off the back of the loss as well for Serena is how that resonates in the locker room. And I think that's often a point that's overlooked, and that more and more players will have the belief now when they take her on in big matches that she can be fallible in those tight situations, in those very important situations. So it's a double whammy. You know, you lose a little bit of confidence that you can win the big ones, but the locker room also believes, hang on, maybe we can beat her in these big matches now.
Right. No, I think I think Aura is clearly, and I thought the same thing after the French Open. I mean, this was Sonia Kenin basically on the big court staring down Serena Williams. Sure, it was clay, but I think Wimbledon represented her best chance to win that 24th major, at least in 2019. And now I think she's got to figure out what her level of devotion and dedication is. All right, so here's my sweeping question. One of the reasons I enjoy talking to you so much is you have a great sense of X's and O's, and you bring former player sensibility, but you also have sort of a very healthy and, I think, reasoned outlook on the sport in general, and sort of can see the big picture, which not everyone always can. I mean, given sort of where tennis is and everything put together and ATP politics and this ITF madness and 37-year-olds, and I mean, just sort of big picture. Do you like where the sport is right now?
You know what? I'll tell you this. I'll answer it like this. I came home from Wimbledon, and people who would never discuss tennis with me were just talking tennis to me. They were talking about one of the best days they've ever been part of in sport. There was a Cricket World Cup going on at the same time. They were flicking between channels, constantly talking to me about how was Halep able to beat Serena in a final. You know, these aren't hardcore tennis fans, so they don't understand the dynamic like we do. And, you know, every sport has political issues. Ours probably feels bigger to us at the moment because we are in it. It's in our face day in and day out.
Right.
But the guys at the FINA World Championships have got issues right now as well with Chinese.
Yeah, the hammer.
Who
yeah,
they
right,
feel,
right.
You know, they feel shouldn't be there. So, you know, I think every single sport has ebbs and flows in politics. We're trying to shake out some things at the moment. And you know what? It actually might be a good thing in that we can clean up our act and align things better. We might see it as a wonderful hinge point or tipping point in the tennis structure and years going forward. But people talking about Nick Kyrgios, good or bad, I think every sport has a villain and it gets
right,
people talking
right.
about the sport. John, me and you have plenty of conversations about this. Is it entertainment? Isn't it? Is it good for the sport? Is it bad? It is definitely a form of entertainment. So, you know, yes, I think tennis is on a lot of people's radar. And I think that's all you can ask for. How people interpret the sport, we can never control that. And I think if you try and control it too much from an ATP or an ITF point of view, you've got to be careful. I always think in this day of social media, the average tennis fan, follower, the average sports fan is so better informed now than they ever were.
Right.
That you can't control how people think. And I think at least if your sport is out there and it's grabbing headlines for hopefully mostly the right reasons, but hey, don't discount the wrong reasons either.
I wish we disagreed a little bit. Maybe next time we'll come up with some polarizing topics in advance. I had to say, I mean,
let me ask you the same question. You know,
No, it's exactly the same answer. I do these interviews, you know, and it's Toronto radio or someone, you know, National Public Radio. People want to talk about, hey, let's call the tennis guy. And they don't ask about, you know, Justin Gimelstob's name does not come up. Dave Haggerty's name does not come up. Nobody's caring about Davis Cup formats and this ATP event in Australia. They want to know about Roger and Rafa and Serena and now Coco and like you, what's going on with Sloane Stephens and is Novak going to catch? I mean, this whole big three goat, you know, 2018-16, that's what people are talking about. And we're all in this bubble and it's amplified by social media and it's the conflicts of tennis mm-hmm. where colleagues have board positions and, you know, the same people that we are seeing in the TV halls or in the media also have these appointments. So we're probably extra tied into, you know, the guys at ESPN don't have colleagues who are also on committees that are making policy. And I think that, and I'm as guilty as this as anyone, but we get so blinded by this little ecosystem that we forget that to the average fan, Justin Gimelstob and the ATP, you know, chaos the weekend before Wimbledon is absolutely irrelevant. They want to know, is Novak catching Roger? And they want to know why Zverev is in a slump. And they want to know if Coco Gauff should be playing the U.S. Open and is she really going to be a future champion? They just don't care about the stuff that I think sometimes we spend too much time talking about in our little chambers. But that's my you and I are in agreement, in other words. That's no fun. All right, listen. Next time we're going to do this, we're going to come up with some real sort of we need some real debate. This was far too much backslapping. It's always a pleasure. This was longer than I thought it was,
always
but this
pleasure,
was a great
John.
Great conversation. We'll do it again soon. I hope we'll see you. We're going to see you in the States here, right?
I'll be around the entire U.S. summer. Always my favorite time of the year. I grew up playing tennis on hard courts, so I love to see how things shake out. At this time of the year, it's hot, it's humid, and lots of squeaking shoes. It's always a good thing.
A lot of melting shoes. All right, this was an absolute pleasure, and let's do it again in a few weeks.
Thanks, John.
All right, see you, buddy. All right, thanks to Robbie. Always good talking shop with him, and we will do it again. A lot of you asked for him when we do guest suggestions, and his name comes up often. Now you can see why he is a guest in demand. Always enjoy talking to him. Jamie. Let's bring you in. You can postpone your producing duties for a second and join us. I want to congratulate you before we talk about Wimbledon or anything else. Can I congratulate you? I think this was your first Sports Illustrated cover story, maybe? Was it not? Second?
It was not, but it's okay.
All
Thank
right.
you. I appreciate the congrats.
Tell me what the first one was, and then we'll talk about this one.
last year, right?
Well, yeah, or Russell the year Westbrook.
Okay,
too.
Yeah. So you Odell, are, I should say. So why don't I should, apart from being a great up and coming talent in this business and someone who's a pleasure to have as a colleague, you are also the doyen for Fashionable 50 for this annual franchise that we do. And this year's recipient subject feature was Serena Williams.
Serena Williams. So lots of good crossover here.
Tell us, Dirt, yeah. What happened?
So yeah, we went to London before Wimbledon to do the cover shoot and the interview with her. And if you read the story, you'll kind of get an idea that she was supposed to arrive at a certain time and did not, and not because she was being, you know, she was just hanging out and she was being disrespectful. She literally was not feeling great and had to go to the doctor right when we were gonna have the photo shoot and the interview, and so we had to wait around for her, and she, you know, despite it all, kind of came anyway and you know, put a brave face on and went through with everything. So we were really happy about that, and it was good.
We should say this was the week before Wimbledon.
It was about exactly almost a week before Wimbledon.
So this is not something that she revealed, and this is not something that we revealed, but for the record, she did have as you say, a trip to the doctor that caused this appointment to be postponed in advance of Wimbledon. How was she? What was your experience? We've all sort of dealt with her in different capacities and different contexts. What was your experience?
Yeah, I mean, I think my experience generally with talking with athletes about this, you know, about fashion or style or, you know, things that are not the X's and O's, they're usually pretty receptive. And so she was similar in that way, happy to talk about even her fashion fails in terms of starting businesses that didn't take off. You know, she was willing to discuss those things. And like I said, she put on a smile, even though I'm sure she wasn't feeling the greatest. But she went through with it, and she, was very much a part of the photo shoot, and she directed, you know, in ways that I guess didn't expect. She didn't just stand there and take direction from a photographer.
I think a lot of athletes are like that, but I think she really takes it to an extreme. If you say to her, boy, at 4-2 in the third set, I noticed you started slicing your backhand, you can see her eyes glazing over and you can see her losing interest. If you talk about something having nothing to do with tennis, and it could be Venus and it could be motherhood and it could be fashion, she blazes to life. She so much would rather talk about something other than her day job.
Yeah, I think that it's really interesting to hear her talk about how long she's been interested in it. And also, I think we take for granted how much she actually does off the court. I think maybe people think it's a detriment to her, and especially at this point in her career, that she's focusing on all these other things and doing cover stories and photo shoots instead of, you know, on the practice court, maybe. But I just think it's incredible that she can do all of those things and still kind of make the final of Wimbledon and you know, continue her career for all these years.
Her pressures are not the pressures of other players we see on that ranking list. And then subsequent to Wimbledon, you were at the Fashionable 50 event.
Yeah. So,
and so was she.
And so was she. So she came, and it was really interesting to see her post Wimbledon. You know, I, of course, we all wish that she had won. I had picked Federer and Serena at the beginning of this tournament, and it was looking real good heading into that final weekend. I really did think, the two of them were in good position. And, you know, you talked about this with Robbie, but unfortunate situation for Federer, kind of grinding it out to the end there. For Serena,
two very different kinds of finals.
Very different finals. But she was, you know, she was great, and there was a ton of other athletes there.
And this was in L.A. I mean, set the stage. This is after Wimbledon. She's showing up in L.A.
Less than a week after Wimbledon, she's in L.A. I think she had a board meeting in San Francisco that morning, so she was on planes for almost the entire day before arriving there. But there were a bunch of other athletes there to celebrate, and, you know, NBA, NFL. One of the most interesting things to me was when she finally showed up on the red carpet. All of those athletes kind of came out from the party, or, you know, some of them, a group of them, and had their phones out and were, you know, sort of elbowing me there, being like, oh, that's Serena, like, look. And it was so interesting to kind of see these guys who are obviously most of the time on the opposite, you know, end of that, receiving that attention, to be just like amazed by her presence. I mean, most of these guys had never seen her before. You know, we had Malcolm Jenkins, who's on the Eagles. He was like, can I get a picture with her, please? Like, you know, I really, and he was posing next to her cover. I think he posted it on his Instagram. I mean, seeing people like that be so enamored with her, just her presence, and just, it just kind of shows you how much, you know, people really respect her as an athlete, as a person, as a woman. I thought it was really interesting.
No, I always think that's neat. I always think we get out of this tennis bubble, and in tennis, she's 23 majors and back to playing Indian Wells. And we sort of lose sight sometime of the macro place she has in this culture of ours, not just sports culture, but culture. And we know her for chasing Margaret Court and whether or not she's moving well on the grass. But this is as A-list a celebrity as, you know, I mean, the Royals were coming to Wimbledon to watch Serena Williams. And I've seen the same thing, that these, you know, Lewis Hamilton, these absolute A-list athletes still melt when Serena Williams walks by.
Yep.
Did you interact with her at the event?
Yeah, we were kind of just hanging back in the in the little VIP area. You know, like I said, it was interesting to kind of watch her interact with other people. And she was there to have a good time. And I think, you know, she, at the end of the day, she kind of just wants to do that sometimes. And yeah, she said she was happy with the cover. She posed next to it. And I will say that the cover pose and the idea behind it was her inspiration. You know, we collaborated on a few different ideas, but she wanted to do something that really was powerful and statement making, like that cover was. So,
and say she was the same way in 2015 when,
right, for a sports
person. Sportswoman. Yeah. Sports person. Well, seriously, congrats to you. That's
Thanks.
Great. Good for you. Everyone should pick that up. That is the new Fashion 150 issue that JB curated and wrote the cover story. So that's great. Any quick thoughts, getaway thoughts on Wimbledon, watching from afar?
No, I mean, we said it. It was a tale of two very different finals. You know, good on Simona Halep. I think you might have used the word nerveless to describe. It was
that.
A takedown.
She's real. Can I say something too that I didn't say before? She's really cool. She's just like the kind of person you want to hang with. Good people. She's. I mean, there's not a lot of fuss there. There's not a lot of drama. She did the rounds after and couldn't have been like more gracious about it. She's you know, we don't root in the press box, but it is nice to see someone who has paid some dues and had some hard losses, but also is just all around good dude. I thought she played great, but I also thought she really distinguished herself in victory as well.
I agree that, you know, we've seen her have some difficult losses and just not able to pull through when we thought she was going to, and now that she's finally gotten that first one, it's nice to see her come to a final and just completely dominate. On the flip side, I was very shocked at Serena's just lack of, I mean, it's been a few finals now where there just hasn't been much competition in the final. And I do think the idea of number 24 is really hanging on her. I think that pressure is a lot more than she makes it out to be. And it's incredible of someone with as much experience as her, as many majors as her, everything she's been through, that something like that can still provide so much a pressure, and that expectation can really weigh on a person. I think it just says a lot about the accomplishment, but also just about her.
Yeah, no, I think they're... She doesn't always give up much, as you yourself witnessed firsthand, but she has been very outspoken. I don't know about outspoken, but she's made it clear that this Margaret Court, here's this woman from Western Australia who's, whatever, 40 years older than she is, but Margaret Court's kind of her new rival. and she wants that 24, and I think it's a silly record, and I think Serena could walk away tomorrow and we would all say she's the best ever, but she has in her head she wants this goal. She's going after it, and I think with that, I think you're absolutely right. I think with that comes a certain amount of pressure. She's put herself out there. She has made this a target, and when you're two sets away from achieving this goal, yeah, you can get nervy. And, you know, nerves, we think about nerves in tennis as missing first serves and as, you know, some pressured shot making, but also nerves affect the way you move around the court. Nerves affect mobility and muscles, and it's not just how you execute hand-eye, it's movement too. And I think that when Robbie brought it up, how sort of lacking in movement she was in that final, I wonder, you sure, some of that is almost 38 years old. And
yeah, but it's paralyzing.
But I think it's a paralyzing, exactly.
Yeah.
So anyway, we will see what the hard court circuit brings. I guess it's kind of interesting one way or the other, right? I mean, if Nadal wins the U.S. Open, it's right. Fascinating. If Djokovic wins again and edges ever closer, it's fascinating. If Roger, whatever happens, sort of it's worth watching.
And then after that, the drop-off.
Yeah, we're all postponing what tennis is going to look like in 4 years when we're watching players who may have won one or two majors competing in finals and not, going for whatever we had, the 36 combined major. Anyway, all right, that does it for this week. Again, thanks to Robbie. Always great. I thought that was a really good, owing entirely to him, really good discussion. And congrats, Jamie, again. Everyone should read your story and see your handiwork. That was great. And I think,
I think
Serena and Sports Illustrated have a very nice relationship these days. And I think one reason is that she has been portrayed in a way that goes above and beyond what she's done as a tennis player. So stories like yours contribute to that. I thank everyone for all your suggestions and sort of your texts and emails, and we should get so-and-so on the show. Again, these podcasts are really hard to do on site and at events. Some of it is just finding quiet. Some of it is coordinating with guests. Everyone's running in 100 directions.
Schedules. Of course.
There's something sort of counterintuitive that you'd think we should be doing this every day. Maybe we'll figure out a solution for the U.S. Open, which is easier, and we don't have the time differences. But anyway, all right, good listen. We went really long this week. Thanks to everyone. You can subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are sold. We'll have a new guest next week. Thanks, Jamie. Thanks, Robbie. And have a good week, everyone.